afternoon from beautiful downtown Nashville, Tennessee. We are here at EMS World Expo with the Disaster Podcast, and we're here at our lovely podcast booth. We thank Physio Control for allowing us to be here. And I'm Sam Bradley, and I'm very happy to have some very special friends with me today, and we're going to talk about a very important subject. These two I have worked with forever. We worked private ambulance for a long time, and now we all kind of work in the same county doing different, very different things, and they can talk to you a little about that. But this is Elsie Quizzle, Dr. Jim Brazel, and you know our favorite Dr. Jim? Almost
not
Dr.
Yet.
Jim. Not
I'm
yet.
Still
He's
in school.
Working on it. Me too. Jim Logan from Paragon,
right.
And we'll talk some more about that. And what we want to talk about today is special patients in a disaster situation and maybe a little bit about some everyday things you might need to know about dealing with these special folks. And Jim can certainly give us some clinical background, of which I certainly have none. So, Elsie, tell us about yourself a little bit. We'll kind of do an intro and then we'll jump in.
My name is Elsie Quizzle and I work in Alameda County. I'm right now an EMS coordinator at the EMS agency, but I am also a paramedic working part-time in San Joaquin County, which is about an hour outside of Alameda County. So I have been working in the field since 1985, and I also have worked a little bit on the hospital preparedness program, so I know a little bit about the planning part of site of disaster management. And I also have a son. I have two sons, but my youngest, who is now 21 years old, he has autism. So I've been dealing with trying to help EMS interact with people with autism in a little bit more knowledgeable fashion.
And we'll talk some more about this, but Elsie is very engaged in any program that helps folks that are generally underserved. She's been working on identifying and managing homeless folks and all kinds of other things that I wish we had more time to talk about. And by the way, if you're not familiar with Alameda County, it is in California, for those of you that may not know. Jim?
Well, I've been a paramedic for a little while, a few months. And I'm medical director for the East Bay Regional Park District Police Department Air Support Unit Paramedic Program. It's a really long title. I have about 60 paramedics that fly on sort of an irregular basis. I have about 15 paramedics that actually fly regularly. And we provide support to a bi-county system where we fly two ships, and we cover the area basically that is equivalent to the size of about Rhode Island. We're the largest regional park district in the United States.
Jim has been a teaching partner with me for many years also. And Jim Logan.
Yeah, I'm Jim Logan. This year I start my 30th year in EMS. I'm currently with the Memphis Fire Department, Memphis, Tennessee, about 200 miles down the road from here. The co-founder of Paragon Medical Education Group, who we focus on interactive disaster management and education. I'm currently the acting chief for the City of Memphis Office of Emergency Management.
You're a busy guy.
You keep me busier.
But we have fun when
we
do this.
We do.
And also, I want to acknowledge Dr. Joe Hawley. He's out there. We just didn't have enough chairs. So say hi to Dr. Joe. So, Elsie, why don't you start off and talk about autism in general. I know you both understand the spectrum. A lot of people don't. I think having a general understanding of that, and then about your son and autism in general, and then we're trying to translate that into how do we handle them in a disaster situation.
So how much time do we have?
We got
6 or 7 hours. No. Just a brief overview.
Okay, so the way that I explain autism to folks who are new to understanding it is autism is a diagnosis that's achieved when the person at risk satisfies so many criteria that's on the DSM-5. So I don't know the numbers. I just know that there's certain behaviors that are on this list, and if you satisfy, let's say, 6 or 7 out of the 12 behaviors, and any of you can correct me on the numbers because I don't remember. It's been a while. It's been 22 years since I've actually dove onto that side of it. Then you are diagnosed with autism, which comes from psychologists, and a number of assessments go typically to the child. So My son displayed things like no eye contact, delayed verbal skills, not really social. He is social. I don't know, when you're around people with autism, you get it. And thankfully, you don't need a lot of words, because some of them don't use a lot of words. My son could not have a conversation, but we still converse. And it's been great, because I taught him how to message me on his iPad, so we do converse a little bit. It's kind of cool. It's kind of cool. But let me see, what else do you want me to say?
Well, I remember something you told me one other time when we were talking about this, and it's like having a cafeteria, and you
yes.
have a lot of different choices of things on that
right.
plate. But if you pick, what was it, six of any
yeah.
of those things. So this is why not all autistic people are the same.
Exactly.
You can pick six things that are all different.
Yes, and you put them in different orders.
Six things
yes.
creates the diagnosis.
Exactly.
Would that be true?
Exactly. And that's why the spectrum is so broad. And they always say, you know, if you've met one person with autism, you've met one person
that's
with
right.
autism.
Exactly.
Because, you know, although there's great similarities in their behaviors, and there's, thank God, there's a standardized way that you can approach each. I mean, just like with any human being anyway, you should really appreciate everybody as an individual and approach them in that manner.
So.
Well, you're exactly right, and that's the art and science of psychiatry. You have a number of diagnoses, and each one of them has a list, and you have to pick the things from the list that that person satisfies. And that's why psychiatry is such a kind of an artful form of medicine, because you can't pin one type of thing on one person.
Well,
there's
speaking
multiple
of that,
things.
Just to make it more complicated, right? So you have the autism spectrum, which is complex, as we all know. And then the older they get and the more experiences they have in life, and if they are communicatively disabled, for lack of a better word, you know, they're not always able to sort through their problems. So some of them, many of them, develop mental health issues, which
oh.
aren't recognized. It's difficult to get a diagnosis for that, because you can have anxiety and have autism. Imagine if you're not able to communicate with the person next to you, the people that you live with, to explain your wants and your needs, if you're happy about something, if you're sad about something. If you can't explain that, then you might get a little pent up, right? So anxiety is what happens. And sometimes people will just attribute that behavior to the autism, where it's really more attributed to anxiety. And so being able to see both of these diagnoses, you'll see in the next few years that's going to be an emerging need and specialty, because, you know, with all the interventions that have been going on for kids with autism, you know, they're getting more able, and they're becoming higher functioning in our communities. So we have an older set of populations where when we were early in the field, you know, these people were in care homes. You didn't really interact
right.
with them with a lot of usualness, right?
But even think back to when you were in school. That weird kid that was really smart, that didn't know how to interact, and always sat off in the corner. And every class had one or two.
A lot of assumptions.
And they were probably on the spectrum somewhere.
Yeah, so I got one at home like that.
Well, and that's what
well he's not at home anymore.
He's
20. He'll be 20 in a few months.
And so when he's not home.
So he's. We never thought he would drive a car. We never thought he would go to college. But he was
awesome.
He was a kid that sat in the corner, was smart as could be, straight A's, but just didn't have the social skills. So he was a little professor, right? Little professor syndrome that you'd hear about. But my grandson also has special needs or functional needs. He has trisomy 17P. So what I worry about with disasters is that, you know, there's so many facets that we haven't even touched on with that population. Sheltering, if you can imagine, like you said, the social skills and being out of sorts and out of order, it just sets these folks into another realm, if you will. So it's something to be to be discussed, and I applaud you for bringing this to light, because it's something that it concerns me. If you can imagine having a child of any age and being in a hurricane situation where you're out of your home and in a shelter in a gymnasium, it would be devastating to that child. And so to make some concessions for that is, I know there's groups out there doing that right now, working towards that effort, but for the folks in the field, the first responders, I think we don't have near enough education. Or, you know, this could be a whole session for a continuing education opportunity. So that's, I'd like to talk about that for a little bit if we could.
Well, explain a little bit about Trisomy 21, because I have to tell you, I don't have a clue.
Well, so you could probably answer this better than I could. All I know is Trisomy 17P, it's not Downs. It's a form of mental retardation. They're just very slow to develop. But they do develop. I wouldn't give anything for Caden, and he's a joy. And we communicate without having those verbal words, and when we're making strides and milestones every day. But he's in a wheelchair, doesn't walk. He'll be 4 in March, but Trisomy 17. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Not too familiar with 17. What we do know and what I have learned is that there are monosomies that will survive, and there are bisomies that will survive, but most don't. We have 13, which is Patau's. Those tend to have growth disorders and different things, and those aren't supposed to survive past the age of 6.
Right.
18, same story, different growth disorders. Edwards is their moniker. They will survive into their teens, but usually not. And then we do have the 21, which is Downs, and we understand about that. And what we see now is that Downs... diagnoses or patients or people with Downs are actually living longer, but they do have a propensity in the age group of about 40 plus to start developing mild cognitive impairment, and some will call it Alzheimer's, but to truly get that diagnosis, and we have to do an autopsy on your brain, so we really can't say that when you're alive. Mm-hmm. There is that issue with the sort of downturn in their lives with the mild cognitive impairment toward their 40s, but there are plenty of people now living well past their 40s with Downs that don't get that, and those would be a mosaic.
I think there's not enough known about the Trisomy 17, and
well, you said what, are there 50 of them in the U.S.?
I think so. There's a very limited number of people that have it. But with that aside, it's functional needs and special needs, whatever the politically correct word is of the day. I don't mean to offend people, but they have special needs, they have functional needs, bottom line. And especially with everyday life, but when we deal with disasters, we have difficulty with that, and we have I would like to think that we have the coping mechanisms to handle that, and it affects us with depression and anxiety and things like that. So it's good.
Well, you bring up a good point. Let me just to interrupt, but what you were talking about, like putting somebody with special needs into a shelter, I can only imagine what that must be like. Not only for the person with this disability or the special needs, but imagine for their family. Because normally you have the safety of your own home that you can either control or ignore the behavior, whichever one is easier or appropriate, right? And now you're going to be thrust into this chaos of people, this frenzy of people, and everybody's freaking out. And then you really can't expect what kind of behavior you're going to get out of your kid. Right?
No.
You don't know if your kid is going to start running around and flapping and screaming, or, you know, in the sake of a disaster, like my son heavily relies on the iPad. I'm going to tell you, I heavily rely on my son having an iPad because it engages him and we can communicate through this way. And not that we can't speak, but it just makes things a little bit easier, right? I remember reading an article, and this one woman, I'll say, her younger sister has autism, and couldn't function without her iPad. And how can you explain to somebody who doesn't really have verbal skills that there's nobody has electricity. You know, you can't charge this up anymore, or we're going to have to wait for the electricity to come on. And then how do you try to comfort these people and then the family that supports it and nobody understanding and, you know, and they're too worried about their own personal stuff to have that inch of tolerance for that next family.
Well, in a disaster, too, we should think about removing one of the parents or the care provider, and that's going to cause chaos. Yeah.
In some cases, and we know in a lot of our disasters where folks have been separated, and I think this would be your worst fear, is one of you who knows how to deal with this person and you're calming to them. Because is it not true, Elsie, that they have very standardized and regimented lives, and if anything disrupts their pattern? So take that to the level of, it's 100 times worse because you're in the middle of a disaster and nothing's the same and it's chaotic and you have no electricity and nothing is the way they expect it to be or need it to be.
I'll say that it generally, I think, honestly, it's that way with everybody, with every single human being.
Yes.
And I think that if you're normal, you keep it in check. And sometimes. But if you have a little bit of a problem with your inside voice.
It's a filter, right?
That filter.
It's a filter.
Yeah. There is no filter.
Then that's, or, you know, yelling and kicking and screaming or whatever it is that you want to do, that sometimes you feel like a normal person you want to do, but then that person with autism or any other special needs, quite frankly, isn't feeling any different from the next person. They're just letting it out.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Right. Well, I mean, and all of us can appreciate the type A personality of EMS.
Really?
Oh, right. I hope. Yeah. And I think we all have a little bit of that in us. I mean,
we're
I certainly
just talking
did.
About like these specific 2-inch pieces of tape.
Exactly. Two inches apart.
More than two
sets.
Inch, yeah.
Two IV bags spiked.
I never did that. No.
I don't know. I had to in the back of my bus
yes,
every day.
You did.
Two bags. Oh, 2 inches apart. So and if I got put in a backup unit, oh my God.
Okay. Yeah, so it's over exaggerated, right? Yes, it's over exaggerated exactly. in these children.
Yeah.
Right.
You move one thing in their room
yeah,
and they'll know.
Right, exactly. You gotta start I'm starting to wane that child from my vocabulary because my son is an adult now, which I won't talk about the fact that he's 21. But
Jim, earlier you mentioned Asperger's, and I know that's a little, it's a type, it's on the spectrum.
Yeah.
But I know those folks in particular have issues with filters. So it's just showing, this is one example of so many differences. So Jim and I, and we both are DMATters, and of course we know that Jim is USAR, and this is the queen of Urban Shield. We've talked about that. That's a whole different subject we could get
totally
into.
Totally other subject, yeah.
We're in a shelter after a hurricane someplace. And one thing I know, because I train on the federal EPCR program, and one of the advantages we have is we have a section when someone in triage is checking this patient in to indicate, it's called a survey, and we can indicate what special needs are in terms of communication, if they have med issues, if they have Alzheimer's and tend to wander, if they need supervision. So there is that, but it's only a very non-specific set. So what would we need to know? And of course, he'd probably already know, not necessarily me. What do we need to know about, we have a 21-year-old person with autism. What is it about that person that I really need to know how best to work with him?
Wow, that's a good
big question.
That is a huge
or
question.
Or what do I not want to do with him?
I would say that you don't want to just do the routine that you would normally do. You have to be very deliberate about everything you're going to do. And by that I mean, you know, when you reach out and touch somebody, you know, be deliberate. And what's your affect when I'm going to reach out and touch you and try to comfort you? And you almost have to put this sensor as you're reaching out to know if this person is getting bugged by what you're saying or doing, and know when to withdraw. And then you're going to have to shift and move, you know, and adapt to getting into an area where you want to be able to develop a trust. You know, my son is 21 years old, and he has autism, But, I mean, he has intelligence. So he understands when somebody's trying to help them, him. So it's not as if, it's not as if they're not going to understand.
So use your gut.
Yeah.
And how you're approaching. Because I do remember hearing something about autism where they don't like light touch, but they prefer firm touch.
It totally depends on the kid.
You have to know that.
Yeah. And
but
it totally
depends on
the
that
kid.
Person.
I think it depends on the child or the adult now. But I think they all can benefit from what's the next step. You know, what's going to happen next? What's going to happen in the treatment modalities? And we're going to put you in the ambulance. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. We're going to go to the shelter. There's going to be a lot of people there. You know, some things we take for granted. We know a shelter, there's going to be a lot of folks there. And it's like talking to a child, but you've got to be very, very regimented in what you say, very firm in what you say, and just explain. We don't do enough explaining to our normal patients, mm-hmm. let alone our functional and special
which
needs.
Which we maybe should be.
And so for those, if they can expect what the next step is, they can get it in their mind a little bit, or from my experience, they can get it in their mind and kind of settle with it and go, okay, and they'll look for you for the next answer, what's next?
And even if you can't, if you're saying it, when he's saying it, it really means communicating it, because they might not necessarily be verbal. With what I've observed, I've sort of described some folks with autism listen like some people with, what's the one where you mix up letters?
Oh,
Dyslexia.
Only it's an auditory type of dyslexia. So you
that
can.
That was supposed to be funny.
But I got it though. I just didn't want
but
to laugh out loud.
But I'm deaf because I can't.
What?
Exactly. So the whole mixing around of words, it sort of impedes their ability to understand the language.
Yes.
But you can show them. You can show them pictures. You can point. You know. Again, it's not about. Yes, you would take simpler language, but you still want to explain. Yeah. But a lot of times you might need visual prompts and cues so that they understand. And it's all about being resourceful, which EMS is the best at.
Right.
So.
And I think, you know, the take home for the people that watch or listen, when you were an intern, if you're a paramedic or if you're an intern now, your preceptor's telling you to say everything that you're thinking. Mm-hmm. You just have to do that with these folks. You just have to be out like they are.
Mm-hmm. I did a lot of work with the deaf community, so I know much more about them and how they think than. And this was back, in fact, I'd done these conferences, I did a lot of training, because I realized there was a disconnect between how deaf people communicate or are afraid to communicate with EMS as much as EMS was afraid to communicate with them. And it was got to a point where if I can't communicate with them, well, then I just won't do anything. I will wait until we get them to a hospital and we get an interpreter. So my guess would be, and I have to tell you how there are a few situations in there that really made me mad because nobody made the attempt to communicate with them when it would have been very simple. Write something down. So you have different ways of communicating with your people, and I would guess that it would be figure out what that is. If they have their iPad and they're holding it out, or they can look at pictures, but use your gut and be a little bit creative. Try, I mean, it's kind of funny, but I worked in a city as a medic with a fire department that was mostly a Hispanic situation, but it was such a default to me that when I couldn't communicate verbally, I would just start signing to them, and the firefighters would give me a hard time and say, ah, look, you're signing to those deaf people. I go, yeah, but it's, or you're signing to those Hispanic people. I go, yeah, but it's working, isn't it? It is some form of communication, and even using gestures is sometimes helpful, and it's better than nothing, which was what a lot of people were doing, and that's very frustrating for everybody. So, you know, what you were talking about earlier, you can't use the usual assessment
right.
that we would use. So
well,
what do you recommend?
You really need to practice your paraverbal and your nonverbal and be very aware of what that is, right? So paraverbal is how loud are you being, what's your cadence, right? Just your tone. And then your nonverbal, your facial expression, your posture, and, you know, this means one thing, and the scowl on your face. So these kind of things help to communicate what it is you're trying to say. So everybody's going to be in a rush come a disaster. It's always about doing the most for the most And so unfortunately, it's these few little ones that will kind of slip through the cracks. But when you're dealing with somebody with special needs, you have to slow down.
You have to spend the time.
You have to like take that deep breath and be conscious of what you're doing. Because if you do the wrong thing and you approach them the wrong way, you really could escalate any kind of thing that's going on inside of them, and who knows afterwards, you know, a month later, 2 months later, a year later, you've developed, now you have like this trauma that,
right.
that they're going to have a harder time dealing with and coming to terms.
Makes the situation more difficult.
You have to read their nonverbal cues because they can't. Yeah. They can't read yours.
Right, yeah, that's a good point.
What are your thoughts on that, Jim? Communication.
Yeah, well, I think there's the acute. There's two phases, right, to the disaster. There's the response, right, to the initial response, or the acute phase, and so there's a communications that you got to use during that, and that would be any call you make, right? So there's a certain skill set you need to have, like you said. And then there's the long term, right? When you're the medic or you're the nurse or you're the Red Cross volunteer working in the shelter or wherever you're at, there's going to be needs that happen down the road, depending on how long you got to be in the shelter or whatever it may be, getting back into the house, those kind of things. So I think there's two different. There's just a lot of work to be done in this area.
A lot of work.
Yeah. And I know there's people doing that. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
No, she is one of them.
I think the Red Cross, you know, they do a great job with their. With their mental health, I think they've got a long way to go, like everybody else does. But you know, when you're in that disaster mode, it's all quick and it's all fast, like you said. And you know, sometimes we just need to sit back and take it in. And you may have a situation where you've got a family, and for goodness sakes, you know, don't separate those people. You know, families have to, you know, stay together. We witnessed that in things like. Katrina.
Yeah.
So, you know, we were separating families. It didn't mean to. It just something that happened. And so, it's lessons learned from all these things. And you know, it just seems like the autism spectrum just keeps getting more populated every year for whatever reason it is. So this is something that's not going to go away.
So is that growing? I have heard that there is a higher incidence.
Well, we were talking about that before we got
really?
On the air.
Yeah.
What do you know, John?
Well, they reordered it in the DSM-4 TR. They reordered the spectrum, and that made it appear as though we had this huge spike, but we really didn't have a huge spike. We just put the people in the right places in the diagnosis. And now in the DSM-5, it's the same way. It's a spectrum, and people fit in certain places. And we're starting to identify more now where that little professor thing is happening. We're identifying that child might have Asperger's. Maybe he's over here on the spectrum. Maybe there's another child in his same school that's over here, and he's Asperger's as well. So they fit in different places, and it's how the puzzle fits, right? So they're... got that 12 sets of criteria, and each of them meet a different four,
mm-hmm. right?
And they're four different total presentations, but they all fit into the same subtitle, just in different places on the spectrum.
Well, I think mental health in general, when you're looking at a shelter, and we are assuming, now, or let's not say at a shelter, it's our medical tent.
Right.
People are coming to us for medical care of all kinds. They're out of their meds. They have injuries, they're sick because of the water, all of these things. But then you have that component of mental health victims that may or may not have illness or injury. But it's difficult because those people need care also, but it's a whole different level of care. And unfortunately, we may or may not have mental health trained people within that group that's working that shift on that day.
Exactly. We only have a limited number of people in our DMAT that do that.
Right. And it would be nice if we could even have a separate place for those people to go so they can be with those specialized caregivers that really know how to work with them, but that isn't always the case.
I've been working a lot with Dr. Schreiber and and Dr. Shields from UC Irvine, and they have the whole size start and respond to resilience training.
Right. That's right.
And one thing that I've really learned, first of all, when you're talking about somebody who doesn't have an injury, they could actually be what's considered a mental health casualty. You can have mental health injuries. And it's not that you don't, you know, you don't see these physical things that's so easy for us. Like you have a laceration, contusions, dislocation, fractures. We can deal with
that.
We
know what to do with that. Yeah.
Right. But what's more subtle is the idea that behaviors are really the symptoms, the signs and the symptoms of a mental health disease or a process is exhibited through their symptoms, like any other disease or process, and that those symptoms and signs are the behaviors. So if you can kind of look at it in that framework, you can almost see how the different behaviors start branching off. Oh, well, that's more like depression, or that's more like anxiety, or that's this person's behaving more like, you know, they have schizophrenia or something, or bipolar. You know what I mean? If you start looking at it that way, like chest pain, if you have chest pain, I'm not thinking you have a GI bleed right off the bat.
No.
Right? So those type of things. But that's a whole other subject.
Right.
Whole other subject.
And certainly that could be in your differential diagnosis. But there are things that you're going to look for too, right? The self-soothing behaviors that Asperger's or anyone on the spectrum that could be the autistic child or adult will start to display. If they don't normally display those all the time, and now they're displaying them malignantly, trying to self-soothe, and we're looking at that thinking, wow, he's harming himself. Why is he hitting himself in the head repeatedly? You know, because that might be the way he self-soothes.
If there's one thing that I can recommend for anybody and everybody is to watch, go to YouTube and watch Autism Angel, and it's about Carly Fleischman. And it's a great story. It's a great story about this Carly Fleischman who has autism, and she's actually more severe than my son. And she's able to communicate via computer. You gotta watch it on YouTube. I'm getting all choked up.
What was the name of it?
Carly Fleischman Autism Angel. It's on YouTube.
Wow.
And it's a great story. And if you wanna talk about that self-soothing thing, she talks specifically to that. So, yeah.
And there, you know, that brings up an interesting thing, but I can't remember her name right off the bat. But there is another person who does education all across the country who is autistic. But she's gotten herself to the point whether,
You're talking about Temple Grandin.
Yes, yes. See, she's so knowledgeable. But it doesn't show that these people are stuck where they are. Many of them do learn. Many of them do get past those hurdles, and many of them do learn how to communicate better.
And Temple has that great card, right, that the kids can point to the pictures?
Yeah.
That picture exchange communication system.
Yeah.
So that's very...
And every time a parent does learn to communicate, say with an autistic child, they then learn another skill. They then learn something else that they can use to help other parents. And I know in the other county close to where Alameda is in Contra Costa, I work there also, and we did some training for all of the fire department personnel and the EMS personnel, and the person that did it works with one of our fire departments, and she and her husband, who both work for the department, have an autistic son, and she is a real advocate. She goes out to other parents who maybe just have been newly diagnosed and they're really freaked about this thing and they maybe have a negative reaction to it, trying to help them understand a little better. And it takes so much patience and so much support to deal. I mean, dealing with children in general is mind-boggling,
well,
but then to have to go this extra level, but they need support.
There's a lot of different organizations who are working to deal with everybody to hopefully get their loved ones who have autism taken care of. And Dennis DeBow, he's out of Florida. He has some training that's geared towards first responders. It's really about awareness, and then again about that taking your time and kind of understanding some of the different cues, right? If you look up the, I think it's the University of Massachusetts, and they have a great program specific to disaster. So we all, and I gotta tell you, I'm bad. I don't have as robust a disaster plan for my own family, you know. I keep saying I'm gonna get a kayak because really half of my family can't swim, so, you know, I live right on the
right
water.
Right now we're in a drought, so it's not a huge issue.
I still live next to the water. All it needs is an earthquake to kind of shake us off into the bay.
That,
so,
yes.
But they have a disaster planning template. And so that's one of the things that you can do as somebody Well, you should do anyway. But if you have somebody with special needs, you know, what are your steps? You know, do you have your supplies in order at home? What are you going to do if you are reliant on electricity? Do you have your little hand crank? Mm-hmm. Do you have a generator? Do you have a solar-powered charger, right? So what are your plans for the wheelchair access, you know, for whatever your hazards are as far as disaster is concerned? Those kind of things, you put it on laminated paper, sorry, because lamination makes things important. Right. That's what I've been told. And then you can plaque it up anywhere in your home. If you get responders, you can hand it to them. So
good
let's
idea.
Just say, unfortunately, you get hurt or you're not able to communicate, your plan is there. And especially if you have somebody with special needs, you can put it out there on the plan.
Well, Jim, you're the disaster planner. And I think her point is a really good one. First of all, have a disaster plan for your family. You know, I taught earthquake preparedness for many years, and it's just things as simple as have an extra month's worth of medications, critical medications, because we never think that that's going to happen to us. It always happens to everybody else. Not going to happen to us. Have those things. Have an extra pair of eyeglasses. But let's go a step further.
Well,
this is what you do.
I think that if you have a child in your home like that, to have a disaster plan is very important, period. But I think if they're capable to involve them in the planning of that, and they love to organize things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the hand crank,
that
just brought back memories.
Great.
So, you know, you're in charge of cranking up the battery for the weather radio or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Having the smartphones, you know, we all here in the South, I know you guys don't have them, but in the South we still have tornado sirens, right? And we rely heavily on those, but those are for outdoor warnings. Indoors, if we have a storm coming through, straight line winds, whatever it may be, we all huddle in the closet or the basement or wherever it is, in the pantry. Have a smartphone. Have that person involved in it. Your son knows how to use that iPad.
Mm-hmm.
He can go to the weather. He can go to whatever, and that can be his job. And have those drills and involve them. Involve them. And the more you involve them, the more they understand.
So if you got them into that habit by doing drills, that would be something that became normal to them, and they might even enjoy
it. It's order.
But it's order. But it's an order they understand.
Well, when this happens,
and expect.
When this happens, we go here. When we go here, you get the radio. It's all step. Just like you said, it's on the list. It's on the checklist.
It's on the list, yeah.
Well, wouldn't that be true of kids in general? Because when, kids or adults,
people
we know
general.
If people
mm-hmm.
don't know what to do, then they just
freak out,
run in circles, and get upset.
Right.
But if every family member has a task, regardless of how small that task is, even a small child, your job is to get your pillow or your teddy bear or whatever it may be.
I have a smart child.
You do. Your child is
You know, I won't brag about him, but if you tell him you're going to do something and you don't do that, he'll call you on it. Because he's in that ordered sense of, you know, mm-hmm. this is what we're going to do this way. So if we take him to Disneyland and we tell him he can ride the Matterhorn first and you take him over to Pirates of the Caribbean, he's going to say, no, we're going over there to ride the Matterhorn because we're going to do that first.
It's the wrong land. We're
exactly.
Here, yeah.
We're supposed to be over here. You're out of order.
Yeah.
You know, I just thought of something when you were talking about I have no expertise in tornadoes whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But as far as preparing, this is kind of good for anybody. I just learned yesterday at the trauma symposium what a great piece of prevention when a tornado or an earthquake, whatever hits, you know, teach your child to put their bicycle helmet on and then go and wherever.
Mm-hmm. Good idea.
You know?
Good idea.
Yeah. So.
Yep.
I have a funny tornado story. I was taking a class in a tornado area, and I drove into that area, and the sirens were going off. I'm like, what the heck is that noise? And they stopped. And I went in and got the little apartment key, and I went into the apartment. I was taking a nap, and I heard the sirens go off again. I'm thinking, ah, damn, kids are playing with car alarms.
You're out of your element.
I didn't know what a tornado siren was. And then the window blew in, so, you know.
Yeah, we had a similar. Cool. We had a USAR training, and we had a bunch of guys from California, and we knew we had the supercell coming our way. We practiced the the drills and everything, but the tornado sirens went off. They went outside. I said, what are you doing outside?
Well, that's like, what we do in an earthquake.
We want to see this tornado. No, you don't. You do not want to see this
tornado. Come back inside and go in the basement with us.
Yeah, so we all have our challenges, right?
Right.
Well, and those references you mentioned, I think Jamie would put those in the show notes, because that video in particular, I think we need more resources. I wish we had hours and hours to do more of this training. But in the meantime, there are resources out there, and maybe we can find a few that people can refer to.
Yes.
And as much as, Jim?
Just one more thing. I've been thinking, as you guys have been talking, we do all kinds of education throughout the year with our continuing education with our EMTs and paramedics and the EMT refreshers. And oh my gosh, those can be snoozers, right? These are topics that need to be brought to the forefront for
very
educators
relevant.
To talk about, because they're important. They're relevant to what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And I get we need to go back and refresh on the basics, but to make it, spice it up
give
a little bit.
Give them
something new.
And we don't spend enough time in primary training on these things, because there's just not enough.
Yeah, because it's not on the test.
And I want to, mention.
Don't get me started.
It's not on the test.
Don't get me started.
It's going to help me pass the registry.
That's right.
Come on now. But at Paragon, just mention a little bit about what you and Dr. Joe Hawley do, because you guys, I have seen their interactive training at some of these shows, and it's just amazing. And, medics in particular, hands-on learners. I mean, we're talking about CE and the fact that a research's a snoozer because it's all didactic. They need to get their hands on it and play with it and use it.
Yeah, so there's PowerPoint's a great tool, but that's all it is. It's just a tool to have in your toolbox. We've taken our lessons learned from the disasters that we've been involved in through the federal USAR system with FEMA and Tennessee Task Force 1 and brought them to the classroom and brought them to the cadaver lab with using new tools of the trade and learning by doing. On the disaster piece of it, we use high-fidelity simulation, cadaveric specimens, and we go through and make the disaster real. Because, with MCIs in our textbooks, right, it's not on the test. It's I don't think it's on the National Registry. That may be a question or so. It's been a couple of years since I took the first one.
I got grandfathered in.
Right, did you? So there's about four pages, right? There's about four pages on MCI and disaster, and then we move on. And then what happens when we go to work, we tend to have these exercises and drills, and we throw our crews out in the middle of it, giving them four pages of education, and then we do a hot wash after and say, you sucked.
And this is why.
And this is why. But we don't educate before we train. And so what we do is we take the lessons learned and the interactive and simulated piece and put it together and on a hands-on environment. And it's really a good thing to see, your students are engaged, and so we have fun.
So where can they find more information on Paragon and you? And
I guess the best place, because I can't remember things very, we're on Twitter, Paragon, at Paragon Medical. But Disaster Podcast, probably you can find us there easiest.
I think it's Paragon Med on Twitter.
Paragon Med, yes, right. That's right,
yeah. What's Twitter?
What's Twitter? It's
we'll
a kid,
talk
it's
later.
A kid's thing.
Oh, okay.
It's sort of like Facebook, but different.
Shorter.
It's shorter, yeah. But we're on Facebook as well.
So where do they find you, Dr. Jim? He's sort of on Facebook.
I'm sort of on Facebook. I don't go in there a lot.
You're really not a social media guy, are you?
I have other things to do. I write lectures and I go and give lectures. You can find me all over the Bay Area. I do teach a lot for different providers there. I teach a lot at a Sim Center up in Fairfield, California.
Mm-hmm.
And I do a lot of teaching with you. So if they
find you,
they'll probably find me.
Elsie, Miss Elsie, where do they find you?
That's a good question.
You're not a real social media person either, are you?
No, I'm more a voyeur, actually, when it comes to social
media. Is
that media.
What they call it? Okay.
Unless there's something. I do get on Twitter every now and then when I feel like I need to push some stuff out. But
you'll find her.
Pretty much. You can go to zepmedic@gmail.com.
There you go.
I do have a web page, but I haven't updated it in a while, so it's a Google site. I own a company called Ready Enterprises, so if you look up Ready Enterprises on Google sites, you'll probably find me.
We have to work with you too on your social media presence.
That's why we're here.
Absolutely.
You'll find me on Facebook, on Sam Bradley, or Sam Bradley 11 on Twitter, and certainly on the Disaster Podcast website, and I'll defer to our pod medic, Jamie, who's over there smiling because he didn't have to sit in with us today, and you can find him and all of his shows at Medicast, and there are many more than just us that we'd like you to check out, and there's Dr. Joe Hawley over there. Hi, Joe. We also want to thank Physio Control for allowing us to be here today and have these great discussions, and I'll leave you with this. Disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.